Political Courage, subtitle, Where Have All the Leaders Gone? And I am John Marty, a state senator in Minnesota, and somebody who thinks there is not very much political leadership present in the United States these days. And I'd like to talk a bit about that, why I think that's the case. I'm going to do that without making the argument that there's been a tremendous amount of political leadership in American past, though there are certainly times when I think we recognize great leadership. Certainly times like the founding of the country, during Civil War, probably World War II, during the Great Depression, Civil Rights era. What do these things have in common? Perhaps a great crisis. Times of crisis tend to draw out political leadership, maybe because it's so sorely needed that leadership steps in and fills the gap. And perhaps we can claim that there's no need for leadership right now because maybe we're not in a time of crisis, but I don't think that we want to push that too far, that leadership occurs when there's crisis and is not present the rest of the time, because we certainly can always use leadership, and there are certainly times of crisis right now and that are not being addressed because of the lack of leadership. In searching for leadership, we should recognize that leaders are not heroes, they're not perfect people, we're all fallible, and everybody has their own weaknesses. So we can point out to any leader in the past, if we study enough about them, some great weaknesses in their own things, certain areas where they fell down and were cowardly, perhaps. Other politicians, perhaps certain times of their life, you see some development in people. This was a great era for them. I was reading something about Bobby Kennedy a few weeks ago, and talked about how early in his life he didn't provide much of what one might call leadership in anything, but later on in certain areas he developed a better understanding and became a leader, perhaps in trying to address those issues. So we shouldn't be expecting perfection in leaders. We're not going to get it, and yet there have been great leaders in the past that we can look up to in many ways, despite their weaknesses. What is leadership? I'll try and make a brief definition that we can expand on some perhaps during the discussion, but that would be the ability to lead, or the ability to move society forward in addressing some problem or some crisis. What does it take to provide leadership? First of all, you need a problem. It needs solving, whether it's some injustice or some crisis. That's not part of leadership. That's just, you don't need leadership if there's nothing that needs doing. But what must a leader have? I think I broke it into about five or six things. The first of which is the ability to see the problem. And this may sound easy, but we don't always agree that there is a problem, and many times the majority of the public doesn't see that. Best example of that might be the civil rights movement. People who are not discriminated against don't see a problem. What's wrong with the way things are? So a leader must be able to see the problem, and sometimes the lack of people's being able to see it isn't just that they aren't affected by it, but sometimes they don't see any solutions, and therefore they decide, well, things can't get better than this, so we've got to accept it the way it is. So if you see the solutions as being not available or not better than the current situation, you may not see it as a problem, and a leader must be able to see beyond that. Second thing a leader must have is a vision to see society as having conquered the problem. This also, I think, sounds obvious, but of course, if you see the problem, you can just see, remove the problem, and that's the way things would be. Is that what the vision of a society without the problem or having conquered the problem is? Either it's a very good lunch or something else happening.
They want more.
They want more? Again, I think that a vision to see society as it is, while it sounds obvious, this is one of the most frequently missing things. And let me go to the example of issue of child poverty. I think everybody sees it as a problem, but they're unable to see beyond the problem. Either they don't think we can address it, they don't think there are any answers to it, or they don't see anything happening about it. So we forget about it. We We imagine it is, oh, it's terrible, and we can moan and groan about it, but we don't see any solutions to it. We don't picture the world being a place, or our society, our county, or our state, or our country being free from that problem. We lack that vision. And I think this is much more common of a problem than some people would expect, because if you see a problem, can't you see society without it? The third one, which is related to that one, is the wisdom to develop a workable solution. Obviously, it's essential to have a solution if you're going to move beyond the problem, and that's often the biggest stumbling block. Sure, I can see the world as being a better place if we don't have this problem anymore, but what's the solution? And somebody who proposes a solution, which leader would have to have, can't prove that it's going to work. A whole lot of solutions are unprovable unless you succeed in getting them through, and that often makes the ability to accomplish them a self-defeating enterprise. If people say, well, that solution wouldn't work anyway, why bother to try it? People can put it down to the point that you're never going to have the chance to prove that it might have worked. But you do need the wisdom to develop a workable solution. The fourth thing you need is the ability to move public opinion. And by this, I don't mean just necessarily a majority of public opinion, because issues and problems are not solved in our society by majority vote of the public. And therefore, majority of the public is not necessarily what you're looking for. But certainly in working with the public, you have to provide some new awareness that a problem exists. In a problem, civil rights movement 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, a lot of people, what's the problem? You have to create the awareness of what the problem is and an understanding of how serious it is. The Supreme Court, when it ruled separate but equal schools were okay, a whole lot of whites and many blacks, what's wrong with that? If we have equal schools, what's wrong with that? So leaders in the civil rights movement had to show not only that the schools were unequal, but they had to show that that even equally funded schools may not provide equality, because a child who sees themselves as not able to go to that school because of their race may see themselves as inferior somehow. And the leadership that went into proving that wrong help change that issue. Certainly that understanding is part of the public awareness that needs to be created. And second, as part of this ability to move public opinion, I think we have to appeal to the good in people, the generosity in people. And this is one that, as part of leadership, it's a major ingredient in leadership that is often, most often, lacking in the political process. People have, we can get into the theology of what we are, but we all have good natures in us and bad natures in us. And if somebody appeals to your greed, your selfishness, your fears, the negative impulses in us, we tend to respond that way. If somebody tries to raise fear of crime being caused by minorities, we tend to draw back and we develop more fear ourselves because we're being appealed to in that way. If somebody appeals to, you better protect your pocketbook from government trying to tax you more because it's going to take your money and give it to those bad people, people respond, yes, I want to protect myself in doing that. If somebody appeals to the generosity in somebody, the willingness to help out with fellow citizens some way or another, people tend to respond to generosity. I think we do accept the appeals. We don't buy every word of what we're asked to do, but we tend to respond the way we're approached. If somebody says, we care about our senior citizens and want to make sure they are well cared for and that they're not going to die in poverty in their own homes with nobody meeting their basic medical needs, we should take care of them if that means nursing homes or some sort of assisted living or something. People say, that's right, we care about people. We care about our senior citizens, we care about our kids, or whatever group we're appealing to somebody on behalf of. And politicians are very skittish about appealing to the good in people because they've seen in recent years so much appeal to greed and the negative things in people, and they feel people will only respond accordingly. But if you look back, I think there are many instances in which the public has been appealed to, World War II times of self-sacrifice in order to help the country. People respond if they're asked to respond. And leadership very clearly needs people who are willing to ask, leaders to ask for people to contribute something to others, contribute their goodwill, if nothing else. As I mentioned a minute ago, I don't think the goal of being able to move public opinion necessarily means able to move 60% or 51% or more in order to accomplish something. In many cases, first of all, some of the public is with the need for change. Majority may not be, but you don't necessarily need a majority. Sometimes a very vocal minority may accomplish that. I'm not sure that the nonviolent protests of the civil rights movement persuaded a majority of Americans. A certain minority was recognizing the need for change and already working for the need for change. A vast majority in the South, perhaps, and probably in the North, didn't see any need for change. Did the civil rights movement get people, oh, that's tragic about this or that happening, that we've got to now overthrow these oppressive laws? I'm not sure that public opinion polls at the time would have shown that the public overwhelmingly supported civil rights legislation. And states such as California, with ballot initiatives, routinely had fair housing law, things that were rejected by the voters. So that wasn't necessarily majority opinion, but it was strong opinion among a significant portion of the population that had been moved by the civil rights movement, which put real pressure on public officials to change the laws, public pressure that somehow or another influenced the courts and the political process to change the laws. So it's not necessarily a pure majority, but it is a need to change public opinion. The fifth ingredient, and this is in some ways the title of the talk, is the courage to take on the task. Why does it take courage to provide leadership? Because there are risks. You don't need leadership if there's no downside to doing something. If you are asking, if you are trying to move society forward on some issue, you have to take a risk at times. And politicians are, I would argue, increasingly leery of taking any kind of risks, political or otherwise. And when you look at our country, what a politician is asked to risk in these days on providing leadership, the only thing they're asked to risk is their political future. Certainly other countries, political leaders risk everything, including their lives, in order to speak out. Not necessarily, can't give many examples of elected public officials in other countries doing this, but certainly in Central American things, the Nobel Peace Prize winner last year, dropping on her name, Rigoberto Menchu. Yes, what she and her family went through in order to fight for an end to injustice. They die as a result of it. In our country, political leadership usually means your career might not survive, and yet people are very leery of it. As examples of this, I can pick some unpopular positions, and I'm not going to suggest that leadership means fighting for these things and opposed to the other side, but there are plenty of examples of it. In crime issues, take a politically unpopular position. Opposition to the death penalty. It has cost California a number of years ago, it cost some Supreme Court justices defeat their political careers in the next election because of their stand on the death penalty, or largely because of their stand on the death penalty. In foreign aid these days, I have a feeling it may not cost somebody a political career, but it is a chip against you if you support foreign aid for perhaps the former Soviet Union with the belief that perhaps a few billion dollars of aid there now may prevent another Cold War from developing at some point, from a greater crisis in the future. Yet, it's an easy thing to demagogue against, and therefore it takes leadership to fight for something like that. Civil and human rights has always been an area where you take great risks to do it because you're fighting for the rights of a minority or a group of minorities. The public you wouldn't need civil rights laws if everybody was in the majority. But there's always a minority, somebody who is treated unfairly, discriminated against, and in order to fight for them, for their rights, the other side always sees it as taking away something from us. And that was much of what happened, what's happening right now in South Africa. Whites are seeing, if blacks get power, we're going to lose our privilege, we're going to lose our rights, we're going to lose everything else. Though at times you can, I think you can well make the case that everybody benefits from a society that works together. Nevertheless, there is always that fear, and I think it's a very real fear, that people who have benefited from a past practice of discrimination are going to be the ones who do it. So if somebody speaks out on one of these issues, they may risk their career. Perhaps the best issue I can see in which there's a lack of anybody willing to talk honestly with the American people these days, it would be the issue of taxes. Walter Mondale in 1984 started out in the convention saying he was going to increase taxes. He backed down very quickly. I haven't seen anyone since then at a national level talking honestly about things that are going to work at balancing a budget, which is going to include in some way, shape, or form taxes, because nobody likes taxes. And it's political death. I'm told that Washington State right now is facing a couple of propositions this year to throw out everything the legislature did last year, at least everything related to the taxes. That's kind of an unusual and very cynical way of perhaps dealing with public policy, but the fact that it may have a chance of passage would suggest that the public is very cynical and very anti-tax, and therefore a politician who talks about that can be sure it's not going to help their career. It's going to hurt them. It may not be fatal to a career, but it's certainly not going to help. Little examples are easy to come up with in my own state legislature. One of my colleagues who has been developing some feistiness in recent years told me once, he sat in front of me on the Senate floor, he said one time after a vote on, I believe it was a gun control issue, how he hated the NRA and he disagreed with them on everything, he had just voted with them on something. And he said, someday when I decide I'm not going to run again, I'm going to vote against them every chance I get just to teach them something. And I thought, you know, this is a guy who I can picture every election, well, should I run again? He can't really decide if he wants to run again. And yet, because of, there's something internally about you want to protect your hide, he's scared of them, and so he votes with them. There are lots of little issues, popular issues that that you don't dare vote against because you're scared of them. A few years ago, Minnesota gave free fishing licenses to senior citizens. Nice thing to do, but I mean, why senior citizens? Why not 25-year-olds or anybody else? The senior citizens economically worse off than 40-year-olds or 20-year-olds or teenagers? I'm not sure that they are. They may not be better off economically, but if we're deciding fishing licenses, prices for fishing licenses based on economic need, there might be some argument for it, but Minnesota decided we were going to give free fishing licenses to senior citizens. And then a couple of years later, they decided it was hurting Game and Fish Fund, which was funded by this too much, and therefore they tried to remove it. And several people came out, and it was a great issue for demagoguery and threats that your next campaign literature were going to have things about how you vote, or your opponent's literature was going to be attacking you for sticking it to senior citizens for a few dollar fishing license. And people were scared of it, to the end that the compromise was, okay, what we'll do is we will charge seniors the same as everyone else for a fishing license, but there will be a refund form, and all you have to do is fill out your name on the refund form, and that you're over 65, and you'll get your money back. It ended up costing several times as much as the lost revenue just to figure out the refund system to implement the thing. And this year, another a nice cause, free license plates for prisoners of war, former prisoners of war. I don't know how many there are in Minnesota. There can't be more than several hundred, and every year there get to be fewer and fewer. And they've always had, for the last 10 or 15 years, special recognition, ex-prisoner of war. You can buy a plate with that, and you pay the standard fee that everybody else pays. But now they... This year, some of the veterans groups came in and said, we ought to get free license plates for prisoners of war. They sacrificed greatly for their country. And sure enough, with maybe 7 or 8 votes in opposition, the thing passed overwhelmingly, free license plates. Well, I can make an equally great argument that somebody whose spouse or child or parent died in a war deserves equal treatment. There's certainly lots of other people, not war-related, who have done equally great things for society. How about police officers who died in the line of duty, or firefighters and all their relatives? Maybe they should all get free license plates. If we're going to do this as a thank you to people, we have to recognize there's a cost to the rest of society. Everybody else has to pay more in license fees to cover the road costs if they're going to get a special break. But somebody comes in there and nobody dares vote against these things because it's too politically risky. So the courage to take on the task is, in my mind, the central thing that's lacking in the political world these days. And before I get into why I think this is happening, the final thing I'd say that's part of leadership, and you can argue it is or isn't, is you need the political ability to accomplish the goal. You could be a leader and not accomplish anything, see what needs to be done, be able to propose the vision on how to do it, be able to move some public opinion, and not be able to get the situation addressed politically through the political process because you don't have the skill to do that. That still would leave, in my mind, somebody as a leader, but it makes them unsuccessful in what they were trying to accomplish, and therefore we don't need to accomplish leadership, establish leadership, if it's not going to accomplish anything. So I'd suggest political skills are a part of what's important in leadership. Leadership is widely available to us if we read campaign literature, including my own. Everybody touts how they are a great leader and they're going to provide great leadership, but that's a buzzword. I mean, everybody says they're experienced, or at least they used to say that till term limits and other things became popular. They used to say they were experienced, they provided leadership, they were well-qualified, they had certain other things. Leadership is always one of the 5 or 6 bullets that somebody uses to describe themselves in the political process. But part of what people have described is leadership isn't really, might better be called something like followership, or perhaps claiming credit for where none is due. If you see a parade of public opinion moving one way and you run into the front of it and wave a big banner and so on, that's not what I mean by leadership. Leadership means challenging the status quo, challenging where the public is. Public may not be opposed to it. They may not be charging at you and you're standing there trying to fight it down. Public may just be standing around and you need to organize that and move it in a certain direction. But if the parade's already moving forward and you get in front of it, that's not leadership as much as people like to claim it is. And certainly back to the civil rights movement, there are a lot of examples of that. Politicians in Arkansas, Governor Faubus and the Little Rock incident, he was not the extremist that he came to be, but he recognized with 2-year terms, he saw his coming up and he saw some other segregationists who were going to start beating him on it if he wasn't more harsh on it. And so he almost admitted that he was getting harder in this way to show he was a great leader and he was doing what the public wanted. I don't know that I'd call that leadership, even if that was a desire of how the country or the state of Arkansas should have moved at the time. It's not leadership to get in front of where everybody's going anyway. The second thing that often passes for leadership is criticism. Critics are not leaders. Criticism of the system may be part of leadership, but it's not everything there is to leadership. Ross Perot, one of my criticisms of him would be that while he's very good at understanding the problems, and he may have great political skills, I think he's lacking several of the other things. Perhaps a vision for what the world is like without those problems, the wisdom on how to get us there, and the courage to speak out and do that. It's very easy to condemn. I can go out and tell you how awful Minnesota legislature is easily. I disagree with them on a whole lot of issues, and I lose on a whole lot of issues, and I can point out very clearly where those weaknesses are. But that's not really leadership. It's easy to badmouth politicians. Everybody hates them anyway. And And I can point out with the federal budget deficit, which is in some ways growing to be the issue that dominates all other issues in the national political scene, not in terms of the public part of it, but it has an underlying impact on everything we as a state, as a country, are going to be doing in the future. It's real easy to condemn the budget deficit because nobody likes it. What are we going to do about it? That's where it gets controversial. Cutting spending and raising taxes are the two most logical things that are going to happen to address the problem, but neither of those are popular. And so as long as you take the easy stand of criticizing the deficit, you're in good hands. As soon as you start proposing what you're going to do about it, you're a lot worse off. And Ross Perot, while he did a good job of uniting people and understanding how great the problem is, and there's a lot of value in that. It's very important that the public begins to realize how deadly the budget deficit is going to be to the future of the economy. But if he tried to go out there and start saying, look, we're going to raise taxes for this, picture what happens to half of his support. If he starts talking about deep cuts in spending things, whether it's Social Security or education funding or whatever, military funding, whatever, he's still going to lose segments of his support. And it's easy to criticize. It's not easy to move beyond that. And it does take both, I would suggest, wisdom, courage, and some vision that are lacking in a lot of critics of the political process. One other thing in talking about what tries to stand for political leadership, it's a good trick to try and, you can sound like a leader by asking the public to sacrifice, asking them to help out, saying you're providing leadership, and then don't do anything. Best example of this may have been 15 years ago when Jimmy Carter talked about how, about the time of the malaise speech and so on, when talking about how we've got to change our energy practices in this country. Energy crisis we have to start addressing, and people are going to have to do this, and in the end, people were expecting all kinds of harsh things being asked. There were predictions that a massive fuel tax or this was going to happen, or people were going to be asked to do this kind of sacrifice or that. And in the end, it seemed to be repeat after me 10 times, I will conserve energy. And that was all that was asked. The leadership would have been there if he had followed through one step further and asked for real help in moving society forward instead of saying there's a real problem here and then stopping there. I think a lot of you, most of you probably, maybe every one of you would agree with me that there is a great lack of political leadership in the country and in individual states and counties and city councils and school boards. Why is there a lack of leadership? I'd like to propose several things. This is something also we should discuss. One of which is, as we move to a broadcast society in which more and more people get their news off of radio and TV, especially television, and the television news becomes a lot less than a half hour of news, but if you take out the crimes, which may be 6 minutes per night, and the natural disasters another 3 or 4 minutes, and the weather, which is 6 or 7 minutes, and the sports, and the commercials and everything else, you may get on average, our state, I know the television networks, the local news, you may get a half minute to a minute on average of political news at all levels, city, state, county, national news on the local news. The total political reporting, I'll guess, averages less than 1 minute. And I don't think that's unusual. Network news at the national level does tend to cover more, but that's because they don't do sports and weather as much. They have some extra time in there, and they do cover it. But the media is spending less and less time on politics in general, and therefore you're getting briefer and briefer chances to be heard. What somebody had analyzed, the average sound bite, the quote they took from politicians back in, I think it was 80 or 84, as long late ago as that, they said the average time given in a quote, and I have trouble believing it was this long, but I was told 44 seconds. By 1988, it had dropped down to 9 seconds. And 9 seconds, you can have one real catchy line, but you can't really explain why you want to do something difficult or something that may be seen as unpopular. So politicians shy away from anything that you have to explain in more than 9 seconds worth. It really is a hindrance to people willing to stick their neck out, because you say, I want to do this because of this, and they drop the because of this, and you get the, I want to raise your taxes, I want to cut this, I want to do that. You get the first part of it in, and your opponents can slam you with equal 9 second times about, listen to what he said this. So the media has played a major role in that. Certainly other new technology things like polling, politicians, somebody joked about one of the former presidential candidates about 10 years ago as saying that if so-and-so was elected, they would sell Air Force One and buy a glider. That way he can go whichever way the wind blows. And there is a lot of that. Politicians don't need scientific polls to tell them where they're getting pressure, and they tend to respond to it. I would guess 200 years ago, when somebody serving in the US Senate from Missouri or Midwest or West Coast states, where they can get home a couple of times a year, and communication was much, much slower. Public didn't have as much of a clue what they were doing. They didn't have much of a clue of what their population wanted. And so they were probably much more willing to take it on. Now, if somebody proposes something controversial in Washington, everybody in the whole country that wants to or is likely to be involved in caring about it one way or another is going to know about it that day, maybe an hour or two later. And they're going to be hearing feedback from instant polling by the networks. It reached kind of an extreme during a couple years ago in presidential races when right after the debates they had these phone-in polls. Not scientifically accurate even, but phone-in polls a few minutes after the debate's done, and then everybody else listens to see what who the poll said won, and then they decide, yeah, they're right, I want to agree, I don't want to sound stupid, I agree that that's the person who won. And so you tend to build momentum against unpopular things by new techniques in polling and communications. The next thing would be more effective lobbying. Interest groups have done a tremendous job in developing their techniques. It's not simply write a letter to your congressman if you feel strongly about some issue. Now groups that legitimately have concerns before the government can turn out massive amounts of mail and phone calls and everything and just swamping somebody with concern. A few years ago, the idea of withholding money from bank accounts for taxes, the banking industry told every one of their customers very clearly, you better stop this because it's going to take money away from you. And it was overwhelmingly crushed. If you talk about any changes in Social Security or Medicare, AARP and other senior groups will be very vocal in letting their constituents know right away how important it is to contact public officials. And sometimes in just hours, more often in days, a public official knows exactly where they're coming from, and that's because organized groups are more effective at lobbying, and related to this, they have more money involved to do it. Interest groups have recognized that for a mere state level $100,000, you can gain a whole lot of access through campaign contributions and other things, and therefore you can develop tremendous political clout. And the payoff, while $100,000 may be a lot of money for some interest in Minnesota, the payoff in terms of an improved tax policy for their industry or their concern, or an improved law in some area, could pay off hundredfold what their investment in the process was. Finally, more negative ads tied in with greater public cynicism is a real negative impact. The public thinks politicians are all a bunch of crooks. I'm happy to tell you I think the exact opposite is true. Politicians are very, very seldom crooks. It's not that there aren't crooks in there. There are lots of problems and a lot of things that I'd say unethical in the political process, but I think most politicians of both parties are people who really want to do a good job for their county or their state or their country, And while they may disagree strongly over how to accomplish that, they really do want to do a good job. And they may be too self-centered in terms of their own interest. What can they do that's going to help them in their family this way or whatever? What's in their friend's interest? They may have too much of that concern on their mind. They are not crooks in the sense that the public sees politicians as crooks. And if society thinks they're all a bunch of crooks, public is, if one of them says, well, you know, I want to do this thing because in the long run it's going to help us all out. Oh, sure, yeah, tell me about it. That's what they all say. So the public is very cynical, and negative campaign advertisements have played into this very well. And that's the reason I think that since 1984, when Walter Mondale got beat up for his perhaps poorly planned and poorly executed a speech on taxes, since that time nobody's dared talk about that, because I can tell you what the negative things are going to be in the next campaign. And I think it's not hard to predict where negative things are going to come. My first campaign, there was a newspaper report, just a quick sum up of some key races, and it told what something about my opponent and something about me. I called the reporter the next day to tell him I thought it was grossly unfair, and I pictured that line in there was going to be quoted in my opponent's brochure. And he said, oh, no, no, you're just oversensitive. Well, yeah, it did appear in their brochure. It's not hard to predict, if you look at negative advertising, where people are going to pick them up and what issues they'll pick them up. So all of these things tend to make politicians perhaps what we might call more gun-shy about standing up to public opinion on something and being willing to challenge the status quo. Public opinion, not, again, as I said, being majority, but the vocal public, which may be a minority, but a vocal minority. Where do we go from here? What are the prospects for future leadership? Good question. I'm not sure where things are likely to happen. The public needs to contribute some by becoming less cynical and less self-centered in terms of how it responds to things. I think we all have to recognize that we may have to sacrifice for the good of all at times. This generation may have to sacrifice a little more, or rather steal a little less from the next generation. We have to be less interested in ourselves, in our personal situation, and more interested in the well-being of society and the future. The media certainly is equally cynical to the public. They also tend to have a pack mentality in which one person writes about this, they all write about the same thing. And I think they're becoming a little bit more aware of the need for changing on this, but they are too unwilling, in my mind, to follow through with things and to write things in great detail. A month ago, I jumped in the governor's race and got a headline, article in our state's biggest paper, talking about my candidacy, said certain things about me I thought were nice and certain things I didn't think were nice. But in doing so, it missed some of the points. On some of the controversial issues I was talking about, it had half the story right. It had the part that my opponent's going to put in, my opponents would put in their literature or their advertisements or whatever, without giving my explanation or rationale. The particular issue there was taxes. And I went and sat down with the reporter, who's one of our better reporters, and spent a half hour with him the day after he wrote the story, twice as long as I had spent with him before he wrote the story, and told him, look, you're always complaining that politicians won't level with the public. Here you have somebody who's willing to level with them on something, and you don't put the whole thing down. And just explaining why you can't expect politicians to step out on a limb if you cut the limb off, and you don't give them any chance for it. You don't have to agree with them. And I don't think it's the media's job to do that. The media can be harsh. They can say, John Marty wants to do this because of this. And they can ridicule that reason even. But they got to at least give the reasons you give for it, and they can't just say the unpopular part of it. And politicians, their role, perhaps the greatest role in this, is twofold. One, they have to look at history better and recognize that following what's popular at the time does not make for good government, it does not provide good leadership, and it's not necessarily politically more successful either, and also involve themselves in some introspection on why did they get involved in politics in the first place. Certainly there are a lot of people who got involved in politics because they wanted a title in front of their name, or I don't know, maybe they wanted to be called honorable. You get elected, you get one more vote than your opponent does, and all of a sudden the mail starts coming in, "Dear Honorable John Marty." Maybe they want something like that. There is prestige involved as well as negative stuff in the political process. But there are a lot of people who don't get involved in politics for that reason. They get involved because they cared about an issue or a group of issues, or just they thought their society, their community could be run better, and they chose to get involved in trying to manage it better, do something better. And looking back at that, once you're involved in the political process and you're starting to be told, well, you better do this or else you're going to lose, or else you're going to be hurt this way, or else your career will go no further, maybe start asking, what difference does it make if your career does go further if you don't do that? I remember the first year after I was elected, and we had a caucus, and while we have an open meeting law in Minnesota and public meetings are supposed to be public, political parties in both houses of the legislature are allowed to have closed caucuses, and people say we couldn't function without them. I don't know that we've ever given a good try at not doing it, but the talk in closed caucuses is always different than what's said outside of them. And I remember a majority leader lecturing me on some issue that he said, I just didn't understand that people who advocated a certain point of view were from safe districts, and I was going to lose if I keep advocating for that kind of a position. And I was furious that, first of all, he assumed I had no kind of political judgment, and I didn't understand that I was taking a risk in doing it, and number two, that he was basically telling me to take the position my opponent had on the issue. And I thought, you know, here I spent a year working very hard to win this job, and now you're telling me, you know, if you want to keep this job, you want to just vote the way your opponent would have voted. Well, why bother to have run in the first place? Why not just let the opponent win? If the opponent's position is that popular and is that right, then why bother to be involved in the first place? So politicians would be well, especially after they've been involved for a few months even, to start looking back and say, why did they get involved in the first place? I don't think that's something that takes years. I think it takes weeks or days for somebody to lose sight of why they were involved in the first place. Certainly in terms of future prospects, as crises get worse, leadership does tend to fill in the vacuum, and there will be great leadership in every state in our country and so on as the need gets so severe that it has to be addressed. The trick is to get leadership before that point to try and avoid crises from getting worse. That's not easy to get, and I'm not sure what the prospects for the future are. I hope they're better than they seem to be at this time. With that, I think we have about 15 minutes for discussion, and I hope this has given some fuel for thought. Yes?
Topic of leadership, and I notice you're flopping around between leadership, politics, a politician's leading, and then politicians. And I thought it was very, I don't know if it's clever, and I'm not being cynical or anything, but when you talked favorably about leaders, you talked about and gave me the feeling that they have to have some guts and go ahead and do something. But then when it comes to politicians, they follow the flow, sort of to say, what's expedient to keep their position. The thing that I'm kind of looking forward to more is that we have some leaders who have some guts to stand up and say, this is my position. And the ethics and politics and politicians has got us into this problem. We don't have any ethics in our politicians. Look at what's going on. If this representative from the Chicago area is going to be protected from this, we the people have to get on the ball and start doing something. Similarly, the press has been terrible. There's no ethics in any of it. So basically what I was hoping to see is that the leaders take a position, be honest, caring, concerned, responsible to the people. And if they're taking the job on of being any elected position because they want to get in politics, to me, that's not what I want in a leader. I'm more willing to see somebody take a position. And we're never going to agree on everything. But if the most of the time they take a position on things that I agree with, that's the kind of position leader I want. And somebody who's not really afraid to stand up. right now you see so many people running, looking at polls.
I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying. Yeah. I think that's what I've been trying to say.
Yeah.
If what you're referring to was my comment that I don't think politicians are crooks, that's what I was trying to imply there is I'm not saying that my premise at the beginning was there is a lack of political leadership. There are lots of politicians who are not providing this. That was the basic starting point. And I think that's what you're saying, and I'm fully agreeing with that. There's not a lot of political leadership, and what we do need is people who are leaders, and by this leadership, as I said, in the title and the most important point, is that means the courage to stand up to it. When I was saying the point that I think I may have confused you on the political corruption issue, yes, there may be, again, I've seen very few newspapers in the last 2 weeks, but the Rostenkowski case I don't want to comment on because I don't know enough about what's going on with that. But clearly there is corruption in places in the political process. What I'm trying to say is the public thinks of politicians as crooked, as lazy, as stupid, as greedy, as I can come up with a few more adjectives, and I think if you polled the public, they may not say that about any one politician, but they will say that about, if you take the U.S. Congress or the state legislature, they will take that and they will assume 90% of the people in there have all of those characteristics. And what I'm saying is, no, they don't. Lack of courage, yes, 99% may have lack of courage. But the other ones, no, I think they may have other failings too. Corruption is not one of them. They may be too willing to, for instance, on campaign financing, which has been a hot issue with me. I've spent a lot of time on that and have had some success in addressing the issue. People do not take big campaign contributions in exchange for votes. That's corruption. I don't see that existing. I do see a big problem. You give me $1,000 campaign contribution and a whole bunch of people from your group give me $1,000 campaign contributions and I'm going to listen more carefully to you and I'll be your friend subconsciously. I mean, you're nice to me, I'm going to be nice to you because that's human nature. And so there's a real problem there. Special interest money does have a real serious impact on the political process. It is corrupting to the process. It doesn't mean that you, by giving me the money, or I, by taking the money, are personally corrupt. And most politicians I know, 99% of them, if somebody offered you $1,000 in exchange for your vote on something, they'd say, forget it, get out of here, and they'd be mad as can be. And most lobbyists, I can think of trying to do such a thing as that. That doesn't excuse the other problem of people, of us allowing a system to go in which people give money to campaigns or give wine and dine people or something, other things like that, not in exchange for any vote, but just because it builds goodwill. And then when close votes come up, you kind of, well, you're a little more sympathetic to that concern. What I'm trying to say is, I don't think the laziness, for instance, I got my opponent last election tried to accuse me of being lazy, and I don't know of anybody who spends more time working on government business at the Capitol than I do. And one night when I got back to my office at 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and there was a message on our voicemail from some angry constituent saying, yeah, I see you're not there, it's 5:30, and you're one of the, your opponent was right, you're a lazy bum, you're probably never around there. And so, is one who puts in way too many hours there, I think. And not the only one. I think politicians, by and large, there are exceptions, but I think most of them are pretty hardworking people, probably harder than average in working. So what I tried to say about politicians is, I think, well-meaning, pretty hardworking, not corrupt for the most part, and all those things. The reason for the whole talk was the lack of courage, the lack of political leadership. So I'm not disagreeing with you on that.
John, it seems to me, though, that there's an unwillingness of the people, of us, to be led. In Oregon, Barbara Roberts is a good governor, as far as I'm concerned, but she can't lead anyway, and people don't want to follow. And you take every poll, and it's 49% one way and 49% the other way. And it doesn't matter what the issue is.
Well, you're right. People don't want to be led always. So I think they do and they don't. I mean, we all want to move our society forward, but when there's something asked of us, we don't want to be the one who sacrifices. We are happy to have somebody else sacrifice, but we don't want to do it. But 49% polls don't mean that you can't provide leadership. For one thing, arguing to get more, you don't have to get that majority public opinion for something in the first place. You do need the political will to do it, and that means she has to, working with the legislature, working with state agencies, has to be able and successfully skilled at pushing it through. And in part of doing that, that may be persuading the public, persuading a small percentage of the public to be more vocal or more concerned, people who are not, who are apathetic to it. And if there's a position that people are 49-49 on, most of the time, most of those people aren't that involved in the issue. One of the tricks of leadership is persuading people. Sometimes it's done through great arguments, sometimes it's done through great rhetoric. Whatever the reason, sometimes it's because the injustice is so great that you can just point it out and make it clear to people. Whatever the thing, that's one of the tricks of being successful as a leader, is being able to persuade the public, and that's another reason there's so few who do succeed at that. But the greatest success, I mean, the founding of our country wasn't the Constitution Convention, all that. That wasn't all universally accepted. All these things were fought then. And the people we worship as clear leaders, I mean, Abraham Lincoln lost most of the elections he ran in his life. He was a big-time loser. He lost many times, won a handful of elections. And we see him as a great leader. He was not that popular, and he had trouble getting things through Congress like every president has had trouble with. And that doesn't mean you can't be a good leader and that you can't succeed on major things. Good leaders do make up for the fact that the public isn't always willing to follow, and that's part of what leadership is moving them in a certain direction when they're not willing to.
In theological terms, we use the word incarnation. So you talk about these principles of leadership. Who's the incarnation of those from your point of view? Who embodies for you nationally or in the state of Minnesota? The kind of political ideals that you see.
Yourself accepted.
Yeah, sure. It's hard to find people. There's a the further back we go, the easier it is to find examples. And part of it may be lack of clarity. And I can easily see right now all the failings of all my colleagues and the others who want to do this. In Minnesota this past year, one of my colleagues, our Senate minority leader, I don't agree with him much on politics and so on, I'll give one example where he took a real gutsy stand. It's a Lutheran minister. He's a member of the National Guard. Very conservative Republican from a very conservative part of the state. And he spoke out forcefully. Nobody expected it. But he spoke out in behalf of legislation this year in terms of gay rights legislation for employment and housing and so on. And it was totally unexpected from him. He came forward and he could have just voted that way. He would have gotten his head chopped off anyway. Even if he had just voted that way and not said anything. But he got up and gave a long and forceful talk in terms of why that was the right thing to do and why he ought to do that. Politically, it's going to hurt him a lot. It was a bold leadership type of thing. There are examples like that. You can give one person on one issue, and that tends to be the way leadership happens to be on bigger, broader picture types of things. It's hard. I don't know of any. It's much more likely you can point out legislators like that or members of U.S. House or Senate who are willing to take a stand and fight hard for something and who may lose elections as a result of their stands on things, rather than at the executive level where Bill Clinton on the nomination of Lonnie Guarnieri for Assistant Attorney General. In that case, he knew this woman. He highly respected her. She had guts. She had some other things. And as soon as political rhetoric started stepping up, oh, she's outrageous and so on. And I don't know if I didn't read a whole lot of her writings at the time. I was watching the thing with interest. They didn't seem that outrageous. But he backed off before she even had a chance to defend herself. The other day, our forum was referring to the Time Magazine article on Janet Reno last week or so. And it talked about how she was calling for an end to some of the mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses in the country, saying it was stupid and we were letting out murderers and rapists out of prison early because we had to fill these things with many minor drug offenders even. And the Clinton administration was really angry at her because it was going to hurt. They didn't disagree that what she was saying made sense, but think of the political message it sends and think how we're going to be hurt by this.
And they made her a leader then?
She is a leader in that way, yes. She's not an elected official, but it's far more common to find leadership in the non-elected official position, maybe because certain leaders don't run for public office, though she was an elected official in Florida. It's a lot easier to find the leadership in times in administrative posts and so on, maybe because they don't feel there is much risk. Yes, John?
Don't you think that the leadership sort of develops itself over time, and a large part of being a successful political leader is one to have a relatively high office, and in order to get to that relatively high office, you have to dodge a lot of bullets along the way. And when you get to that high office, in retrospect, you can see what made that person a great leader was probably a stand on a great issue. But you have to.
But in order to get there,
you have to make some. You have to go with the flow a little bit along the way in order to get there. Mm-hmm. I think it's important for a politician to be principled along the way, but I don't think you can stand up and stick your neck out every time, especially if it's going to be a Pyrrhic victory at best.
Right. The issue of when something is just a Pyrrhic victory versus a real victory is one thing. I won't disagree with what you're saying in terms of visible leadership. In other words, in order to be visible as a leader, you got to get to a high up position where you're visible, and then you provide leadership, and wow, how wonderful. I'd like to make the case that, first of all, leadership doesn't have to be there. Just because somebody's providing leadership doesn't mean we're going to know about it. It tends to be these relatively anonymous cases. Somebody in a local school board who does something really gutsy, somebody who does something, some city council or whatever. There's a lot of leadership around in isolated cases. It may be very small minority, but there is leadership out there, and we just don't hear about it because it's small levels of office. But it doesn't mean it's any less leadership. And I'd like to make the case that the people who make all the compromises in order that someday I'm going to get the position of power, and then I'm going to show some real guts and do what's right to do and show the leadership that's needed, probably, and I can't prove this, but I think a lot of people who get to high office that way do the same thing when they get to the high office. Well, if I have more years in this office, if I'm unelected because if I'm voted out of office because I take a gutsy stand, then I can't do anything good. And certainly I'm better than my opponent was. So I think there's a real risk when people say, I'm going to compromise, dodge too many bullets, do this in order to get to that position. Because once I get to that position, then I'm going to have the guts to stand up for what I believe in. I think if you compromise every step along the way, you're going to do it. And of course, political leadership doesn't mean sticking your neck out just to stick your neck out. And you don't try and offend people. That's not what leadership is. Leadership clearly is doing it. But to the extent if you want to be a visible leader, you may be right. You have to get to the high position in order to have the chance to do that. But if the way to get there is that, you write out a whole lot of leaders on a lower level.
I'm just trying to distinguish between courage and leadership. And I think it's a significant distinction.
I think leadership requires courage. Courage in and of itself is not leadership. You need other things besides courage. I mean, tilting at windmills is maybe courageous, but it isn't leadership either. We have time for one more question, and we better quit for a moment. Yes?
This is probably an oversimplification. Isn't really the crux of the problem what you alluded to earlier after you've gone through a long list of different criteria, and that is ability to put the plan into action and simply state it. What you first got to do is get elected. If you're not elected, the chances of you implementing your program, whatever it be, is essentially non-existent. And in order to get over it,